This podcast is made possible through listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. And the Florence County Museum, presenting Kindred Spirit, The Personal Worlds of William H. Johnson, exploring the painter's artistic evolution and journey of self-discovery from rural South Carolina to Europe and New York, flocomuseum.org. And Meadow Garden, home of George Walton, one of the youngest signers of the Declaration of Independence. Open for tours Monday through Friday, 10 to 4. Learn more at historicmeadowgarden.org and visit augusta.com.
From South Carolina Public Radio, this is Walter Edgar's Journal. I'm Walter Edgar, welcoming you to our podcast series about South Carolina culture and history with a nod to all things Southern. Today, Alfred Turner and I will be talking with J. Drew Lanham about his new book, Joy is the Justice We Give Ourselves.
This book is a sensuous collection of his signature mix of poetry and prose, a lush journey into wildness and black being.
Lanham notices nature through seasonal shifts, societal unrest, and deeply personal reflection, and traces a path from bitter history to present predicaments, mining along the way the deep connection to ancestors through the living world. Drew, it's great to have you back in Columbia and as a guest on the Journal. And we're going to talk about your latest book entitled Joy is the Justice We Give Ourselves. But for those who've been listeners to the Journal and to our podcast before, this is not your first book. You did Sparrow Envy, and you did The Home Place, Memoirs of a Colored Man's Love Affair with Nature. You describe yourself as a bird watcher, poet, I would add philosopher and lifestyle coach, particularly with this book. And you are a distinguished professor of wildlife ecology and a master teacher up at Clemson University. This latest book was inspired by a spiritual your grandmother sang to you.
Mm-hmm.
So how about let's go into that. Talk about that and why this book reflects a darker side of your writing that I've seen in the past.
Well, Walter, thank you for having me back. It's good to be down here, and it's good to talk to you again. Joy is the Justice We Give Ourselves is a little different in that, I think these are the times that really we have to claim the good in the midst of all the bad that we see, that we hear, that we read. And my grandmother, Mamatha, had such a critical influence on my life and really raising me. And I could remember the song that she would sing sometimes, "This joy I have, the world didn't give it to me. The world didn't give it, the world can't take it away." And so to sort of riff off of that, I wanted to take the route of talking about the things that I love, those beautiful birds and the wildness. So many of the places in South Carolina, but then also to have people understand that there's also bitter, right? That, for example, when I'm on some of these landscapes, for example, watching birds and looking over a rice field in the low country, how can I look for black birds or hope for black rails and ignore the misery that was imparted to black people on those landscapes? And so living between the majesty and the misery is, I think, part of the poet's work. And I want to do that, Walter, in a way that has people be in those spaces, to live in between those lines, as it were. So as you read a poem, as you read a piece of lyrical prose, for you to be in a place to say, yeah, that's beautiful. But then to say that that was terrible, and to understand that both things are true.
In one of your prose pieces, and I might say I think some of your prose pieces really are poetry.
Thank you.
The Sweetest War, but there's one sentence that made me think of Emily Dickinson, because you're writing about a hummingbird. Mm-hmm. It is existence boiled down to feathers and flight. That is a hummingbird as it flits in. We are fortunate to have hummingbirds. They like my purple sage. But in several of your works, you cite other writers, and I found that absolutely fascinating. I've got too many underlinings here.
I like that you've worked your copy. That's a good thing.
It's in your major work, Joy is the Justice We Give Ourselves. And in the first stanza, do we still refer to stanzas in poetry?
More or less, I think.
Okay.
Me less than more.
Okay. All right. You say, joy is the justice we give ourselves. It is Maya's caged bird. So obviously, Maya Angelou. Mm-hmm. All right. And then, as only a naturalist would say, joy is the silent spring, unquiet, Rachel's world, not yet come to pass, Rachel Carson, who sort of got the ball rolling on saving our world.
Indeed.
Joy is the healing, broken dreams restored, soaring, Langston Hughes. And then, joy is the surrender, to faith of push, to trust and lift, giving over to Toni's command, Toni Morrison. Now, as soon as I saw the names, that created another image in my mind. Is that what you were intending?
Thank you for getting it. Really. No one's ever brought that up before, Walter. I want to pay homage to those people who've influenced me, whose words have meant something to me. And so, I mean, it's sort of a legacy, right? Mm-hmm. A legacy of love, of words, but also of the images that they create. And then those images that they create, how they make us think and how they make us feel. And again, to go back to Rachel Carson, essentially said, sometimes it's more important to feel than to think. And so these days, you never want to dismiss thoughtfulness or thinking. But I think part of what's happened to us in many struggles is that we've overthought things. And by that, I mean that we've dismissed our hearts. We've dismissed that thing that tugs at us and has us do right or love a thing or a person. So that's what I wanted to come out of that. And by mentioning those names and Toni and Langston and all the rest of them, I really wanted to bring that sort of legacy of love and wonder home.
Well, and sadly, today, social media, the local newspaper, if you have one, internet, everything is not only overdone, you turn on a news channel, supposedly, to get the news, but all you get are talking heads, mm-hmm. and everything is overdone, and it's what if, supposition, and usually what's the worst thing that's going to happen, and let's see if we can, you know, it's like Jim Cantore standing on the battery at Charleston, and, you know, I've got low country friends who, their wish is to see him taken away by a tidal wave when he comes. I mean, it's almost as
okay, I do not understand that reference. You're going to have to explain it to me.
Jim Cantore?
Yeah.
The Weather Channel. He always is there.
I don't watch the Weather
Channel. They send Jim Cantore to where they think the worst of a storm is going to be.
Okay.
So.
Well, it's almost, you know, in that case, the personality almost becomes bigger than the storm itself.
Yeah.
In ways. And you talk about things being overdone. And I mean, they're overdone and they're immediate, and we're supposed to accept it as the gospel. And so there's no room for interpretation, no room for sort of the hues to wash out. So everything is sort of printed fast and furiously and permanently in some people's minds. And I would like to think I live more watercolor, Walter. I like for things to sort of bleed into one another. And in that way, you know, you find some difference, right?
Yeah. And let's do what is directly opposite of that. Paint by the numbers. Within the lines, and a certain color has to be. I like that watercolor image, that world.
The world has become smaller in so many ways, and one of the ways that it's become smaller is for us to not understand connections. You would think that the world becoming smaller would mean that we embrace the connections more. But really, once things are processed, whether it's the crab that's processed and boxed up and sent somewhere else, or whether it's our news that's processed in a certain way and boiled down to appeal to whomever it is that it's supposed to appeal to, think about that. News appealing. You know, it's sort of like, as a historian, you know, we were talking, historian pleasing, really. History is history. The news is the news. You know, part of it is generational, right? The world changing, but it is also taking something sacred, and bending it and twisting it to the demands of the market. And we live in a market-based economy, and I understand that. But I think that what, as a poet, I try to deal in is the heart's commodity. And you mentioned that hummingbird. Walter, just yesterday, I'm sitting out on a little shack, and I'm sitting there, and this hummingbird just comes up and hovers right in front of my face. And you could feel like the little, you know, turbulence that it had created there. And this bird just curious in this moment. You know, I felt like I had been graced by some God at that moment. And so that to me is a watercolor moment. Mm-hmm. I can't, you know, I imagine that somewhere, I'm almost afraid to say the word or even the initials AI for fear that something will suddenly be created that I didn't ask for, right?
Yeah.
I didn't ask for the hummingbird. Evolution made it. But then there it is. And there's nothing to me that can come close to the beauty of that little bird, the moment of feeling the turbulence from its wings with no idea of why it approached me. I can't ask it. And in that wonder of why it did, I can write a few words, but I can't replicate it. But I can try to get you or somebody else to feel something about it.
Well, another side to that beauty is we have a gorgeous red-tailed hawk in our neighborhood. And a couple of weeks ago, because we have bird feeders everywhere, there were some doves on the ground, and my wife was watching out the kitchen window, and then there was this explosion of feathers as the hawk got lunch. And some people thought, how horrible. She actually thought it was beautiful. The hawk was beautiful. I'm sorry, we didn't really care about the doves there. When I got this story, I said, well, I'm angry for only one reason. I wish the hawk had been after the squirrels we've got around the house instead of the doves.
Next time, maybe. You have people who would see that as that act as cruel or ugly or something that doesn't maybe appeal to their human sensibility, right? And I would argue that's been sort of tamed out of us as well, to understand that hawks got to eat, right? And that dove and squirrel are making one another at rates that hawk can eat, and there can still be squirrel and dove left. Mm-hmm. And in that way, that sort of watercolor again of understanding life's ebbs and flows, you know, that bitter moment for the dove that wasn't quite quick enough,
mm-hmm.
okay, that gets recycled maybe not just into red-tailed hawk, but maybe into red-tailed hawk babies. Mm-hmm. That the squirrel the next time that's caught by whatever predator gets recycled into it. And that predator ultimately may be recycled into something else. All that's watercolor. The only certainty about any of it is that it'll happen to all of us, life and death. Mm-hmm. And so for me, again, and recognizing that and what you're seeing and what you and your wife saw, that drama that took place is what the poet, is what I try to bring to the page, but then that hopefully lifts off that page again in a way that you say, oh, yeah, let me pay attention. Let me notice and let me feel something.
Well, would you like to read one of your poems?
I would love to read something. Well, how about this? If I read a selection from, and you mentioned this, it's one of my favorites, How We Spend Our Days.
Yes, that would be good.
How We Spend Our Days. This day is those days which are these days of many hued leaves leaving. These are the days the wind comes in and rattles fall's cage, stripping the maples and poplars nude of saffron and scarlet, but leaving them wrinkled, soiled clothes on beeches and oaks. These are the days of white-throated sparrows arriving in the backyard to sing of old Sam Peabody's poverty-stricken Canadian times. These are the days of deer chasing, of bucks antler rubbing, of does white tails lifting, of future fawn making, the convergent intersected result. These are the days of me wishing I was watching them ghost through at dawn, of me wishing I was waiting until dusk for them to reappear, of me wishing I was above it all, voyeuring into woods' lust. These are the days of the beaver moon hiding behind Earth's shadow, me getting out of a warm bed at 2 a.m. to see it turn a pinker shade of pale. It is the day of me howling to myself.
I had underlined other sections of How We Spend Our Days, and I like towards the end, this is the day I don't care what I look like. These are the days that the mustard greens get bitter and taste best. The days of rutabaga bottoms mushed to a pulp and boiled purple-topped turnips with butter. These are the days of deep-fried turkeys and cornbread dressing, never, ever stuffing. These are the days of sweet potato pie. Pumpkins are for jack-o'-lanterns and for fake coffee flavorings. This is not the day to visit the scale. Now, for anyone who grew up in the South, black, white, and I don't care about what class, they know exactly what you were talking about today. But I was thinking about the cornbread dressing. Never stuffing. Certainly never stovetop. And sweet potato pie, not pumpkin pie, which is just a pulp with allspice touched on it.
Yeah, it's an abomination. I mean,
but see, somehow they got the idea that the pilgrims had pumpkin pie, so now we all got to have pumpkin pie.
Yeah, I, you know what?
And you know, they were thankful for the pumpkins, but we're more thankful that we had sweet potatoes.
Well, but guess what? If the pilgrims had any gourds, they would not have been pumpkins.
No, no.
Right. And
we
and
laid all that on them.
And I don't know the full history of sweet potatoes, but I think they were here by that point, right? But I, you know, it is to me, Walter, a great compliment that people that the poetry can break boundaries down, right? For me, you know, I tell folks when, you know, I did the 23andMe back in the day, and you know, my Central and West African, the 80% of me that is, and then, you know, that part of me that is Brit, Irish, and a little bit of this and that thrown in here and there. And some of those stories are bitter of how that got in, but it is what I am. And I tell folks, you know, sometimes my preference for root vegetables, mm-hmm. it seems is born of some of that, right? And there are times of the year that I crave rutabagas and purple top turnips, and that I do want those greens either when they're new and tender and sweet, or after the frost and they're sort of bitter, and I want to feel the season in my food. And I can't feel that out of a can or out of a frozen bag. You know, when I travel elsewhere and people are talking about this thing or that thing, and I stand up for our foodstuffs, right? And who we are in that way. And it's important, you know, that you go to the farmer's market, that you have that to look forward to, that maybe this year you can say, you know, the collards were really big and tender, and the next year maybe they weren't, or maybe they were harder to find. Or maybe you get to talk to people at the farmer's market who tell you that things didn't go so well with the crop, or they went really well with the crop. And all of that, you know, if you think about it again, it paints a picture. Mm-hmm. And it paints a picture of a relationship. And in my head, now I'm thinking of collard poems. And
well, you know, you talk about bonding. And, of course, we Southerners are fond of things like gumbo. Mm-hmm. I grew up doing gumbo. And that, when we still had a place at the beach, that was part of a New Year's celebration. There was a neighbor. He said he would be my sous chef. He cut up, and I did the gumbo, made my own roux. Whether it's pine bark stew, chicken bog, frogmore stew, all of those are communal meals. Of course, people talk about Brunswick stew, and I have to remind them that real Brunswick stew is made with squirrels.
Well, growing up in Edgefield, there was this little place in North Augusta that Mom and Daddy would stop. And they'd buy barbecue, and there'd be so little of it, it seemed to me, that there was just barely enough, you know, to put on a couple of slices of white bread, colonial bread, eat that. But then later on, I learned about hash, right? Mm-hmm. And hash over rice, and just the, and, you know, heavenly hash, let's go ahead and call it that. But, you know, there's some hash that you wanted, other hash that you didn't. But then learning what goes into making hash, you know, and you can never know fully anybody's hash recipe, because you'd have to die if you knew what they had put in it. But it's going to kill you eventually anyway, because it is what it is. But all of that, to me, you know, is also sort of this blending of beautiful and bitter, right? And maybe the foodstuffs that the meals, these communal meals, mm-hmm. that arrive, because guess what? You got to put all this stuff in a pot, boil it up, because you might not have enough otherwise to share. Mm-hmm. And somebody figured out, well, you know, if I put all this stuff in a pot, boil it up, boil it long enough, it tastes pretty good. Mm-hmm. We'll put it over some rice, even better. And we can gather around that. And to me, that is one of the special things, especially when I think seasonally. I will tell you, I have come in my life at this stage that August is probably my least favorite month. there's not much to look to food-wise, but fall is coming.
Well,
right?
But see, you live in the foothills. You're at least a little bit. How about living in Columbia in August? It's miserable. It's absolute misery. Heat just gets here, and you feel like you got to push it aside like a fog cloud. I mean, it's just, it's awful.
Well, I've always thought, Walter, because you hear that, you know, that soldiers were trained for desert, they trained for desert warfare here. And I'm thinking, you know, there are deserts in North America where you could train, but they choose to come to Columbia to do it. And I, you know, I think about, I frequently come down and a side trip, or maybe it's the main trip, is Congaree National Park. Mm-hmm. And that is such a special place to me. I've probably been in Congaree, I don't know, a couple of hundred times. But in August, I kind of say mostly no thank you, in part because I know that it's going to be buzzing, that the mosquito meter is going to be high, that I'm going to need gills just to walk on the boardwalk, and the birds are going to be pretty quiet. So, but again, that's us. That's South Carolina, right? You know, I was writing the other day on a social media post, actually, and then I thought better of it because people kept asking me. It was kind. They were asking, are you okay? How is Debbie, the storm, impacting you? Mm-hmm. And you know, there's this familiar sort of refrain from folks not from here who think that South Carolina consists basically of Charleston and Myrtle Beach. And
that's been going on for more than 300 years.
And okay, so some Charlestonians would have you believe that too.
But yes, I mean their world stops at Broad Street.
It does. I mentioned, as an aside, a couple of years ago, I mentioned something about Oconee County, and people said, "Where is that?" I mentioned the dark corner, and I was talking about some of the history, and. And they didn't know that Oconee County, South Carolina, existed. So, you know, it's I find it, on the one hand, humorous what we know and sort of how colloquial we can be. But then the beauty of this state, and part of the reason that I keep writing about it and that I will always live here, is because I can be up on Sassafras Mountain in the morning and maybe hear ruffed grouse that you're not going to hear anywhere else in this state. I can be in the sand hills at lunchtime and actually get some good hash over rice. And then by dinner time, I can be in the low country and I can have creek oysters. I can have crab, And maybe I can have some fish off a trawler that was out that morning. And that's a special thing to me. And between those three meals, there's an awful lot of history, right? There's also a lot of history that's not so good. And when I say good, it's not pleasant. History is history. Good or bad, history is history. But then there's this beauty in the mountains and being able to look out and see the blue wall. And then to roll downhill to the sand hills and through pine forests and to be in a place where I can see endangered red cockaded woodpeckers and then to be on the coastal plain. And maybe in a place where I can see dolphins strand feeding, you know, that's just marvelous. And I can do all of that in a day, and it fills my head and my heart with thoughts and notions that can only, for me, be expressed as poetry.
We need to begin to think about wrapping up, and I would like to ask you about the title of your collection. I think it's a remarkable title. Can you tell me how you came up with that?
The title, Joy is the Justice We Give Ourselves, again, is, you know, these are the days, as I say, of bad news, of despair. And if you don't watch yourself, you'll find yourself sort of spiraling. And I think sometimes there's an expectation that we fall into the worst of ourselves. And I refuse to be always angry. I refuse to be always hopeless. I refuse to always see the bad. There's enough of it out there to make itself obvious to any of us. And so joy, to me, is a justice that we can give ourselves. And it came in a conversation at the beginning of the pandemic when all the news was bad. And I'm talking to Krista Tippett of the On Being Project, and she asked me about hope, and she asked me about how I was feeling. And, you know, people were protesting in the streets, and it didn't seem like we would ever come out of that thing, but I felt like that joy was a justice I could give myself, that no one, as my grandmother could say, would sing, nobody can take that away from me. And so if justice isn't going to come any other way, I'm going to get it myself. And sometimes it's in watching a swallowtail kite soar or hearing a wood thrush sing. That's justice to me.
In your essay called Just Being, there are far too many ists and isms still here. Fighting them all at once is like an eternal career, uphill stone rolling. Just call me Sisyphus Jr. The stress keeps me up late into the night and makes me want to lapse into sleep midday, numbing even more. Withdrawing seems the easy answer, just closest family and a few treasured friends, and always wildness and birds. Wildness and birds. At least for now, I think we need to just let you say a few words for our listeners before we do sign off.
Well, again, Walter, thank you. I'm grateful for you and for Alfred and the friendship that we've built over these conversations. I really am. It means a lot to me to be able to get word out in this way, but it also means a lot to have your friendship and to have you working my words. Thank you.
Well, Drew Lanham, it has been a pleasure having you today with Alfred and me on The Journal. I hope you enjoyed our conversation today. I know that I did. In Joy is the Justice We Give Ourselves, Drew Lanham draws canny connections between the precarity of nature and the long arm of racism. This collection of poetry and prose offers reconciliation and eco-reparation as hopeful destinations from our current climate of division. In Joy is the Justice We Give Ourselves, Lanham mines the deep connection to ancestors through the living world and tunes his unique voice towards embracing the radical act of joy.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. I'm Alfred Turner, and I produce the show, which is made possible by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. Remember, the views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio or its underwriters.
New episodes of Walter Edgar's Journal are published on the first and third Fridays of the month and are available at southcarolinapublicradio.org, on the SCETV app, as well as your favorite podcast provider. We'll talk again soon.